This is an interview with Dr. Tony Diaz. He has been a longtime educator and a school board member here in Corpus Christi, Texas. We're going to talk about a broad range of issues during this this interview. So we'll start at the beginning. Dr. Diaz, where and when were you born?
I was born here in Corpus Christi on January the 2nd, 1933. At 304 Coke Street.
Wow. Who delivered you?
In those times, in those days, in our neighborhood, all 100% Hispanic, Mexicanos, Doña Isabelita, midwife, portera. She delivered day and night, seven days a week, babies. We didn't know that there were such things as a doctor.
It's a very common experience.
Yes, right. $10, I say a pop, $10 a delivery. Wow. And if you had the money, which my mother managed to have, if not, she would take payments, of a dollar or whatever, 10 payments or whatever. And she just was on call, and she went from one birth to another.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. And then, so tell me a little bit now about your parents. Who were they? What did they do for a living?
My father was an immigrant from Mexico, Irapuato, Guanajuato. He was born in 1905, and in May of 1924, he immigrated with his mother and everybody in the family. And in those times, the families here and in Mexico, particularly large families, 10, 12, mm-hmm. 14, 16, whatever. So they all, his brothers and sisters, my grandmother, Elodia Carmona, was a widow with all of her children. Some of them married and with grandchildren. They all came to work over here, and also to after the Revolution. The Revolution caused a lot of exodus from Mexico. It's always been.
Yeah. Right.
And always, from the stories that my dad told us growing up, that citizens from his country in Mexico and other countries in North America, Central America, South America, they looked to the U.S. as a place where they could maybe immigrate to for a better life, or particularly for their children. Mm-hmm. Of course, he was not married then. So they came and stayed here. And then my mother, Francisca Cortés Levier, Cortez, she was born here in Corpus Christi, but she was an orphan. She lost her mother when she was 3 or 4, and she has a picture of her mother and herself with her mother, but she does not really recall. She didn't recall too much about life with her mom, just very little. And then she lost her father, Lucas Cortez, my grandfather, when she was about 8. They found him in a field, dead. And so she was an orphan, both father and mother, at the age of 8. And as an orphan, some aunt of hers took her in, never did enroll her in school. She stayed with one family or another, but ended up with mi tía María Guerrero, and she never put her in school. And so she never attended a single day of school in her whole life. My father in Mexico, Irapuato, went through the 4th grade. But when he came over here, he was very smart, very industrious, hardworking. He learned English very well. My mother, staying at home and had never been to school, just knew Spanish only. And so when growing up, because of my grandmother's will, my aunts and uncles, it was in our home with my grandmother. We lived right next to her. all Spanish, puro español. Ni siquiera una palabra de inglés. No sabíamos, a lo menos no sabía yo que había otro idioma, puro español. I didn't know there was a foreign language, English for us.
Right.
So anyway, so we went to school. In first grade, there was no pre-K or K. In the first grade, with Spanish only, and hearing their foreign language.
And that's here in Corpus.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Started in 1939 at the age of 6 years at Sacred Heart.
Okay, so that's elementary. A Catholic school.
Yes, Catholic school.
Now, in public schools back then, you couldn't speak Spanish.
That's correct.
Did they let you speak Spanish at the Catholic school?
No, but we did anyway because that's all we knew. You know, but they would tell us, you know, English, English, English. And we didn't see anything wrong with that, but we just, well, we'd been speaking Spanish all our life. We didn't know about this other foreign language that we had to learn, you know. So anyway, and then 1940, I enrolled in Southgate Elementary with my brother's sisters. And it was across the street on Coke. Then there was Ben Garza Park.
Okay.
And right next to Ben Garza Park was Southgate Elementary, built in 1935. And so Southgate, from 1940 to 1945, sixth grade. In those years, it was first grade to the sixth grade. And then from there, Northside Junior High for seventh, eighth, and ninth grade. Hmm. And then my only year here, a sophomore in Corpus City High School, only high school in town, mm-hmm. and three junior highs, Northside, Winfield, and Driscoll, built in 1940. And so in 1949-50, my only year at Corpus City High School in the 10th grade, and something that impacted my life and my future at that time. We helped our dad doing a lot of furniture refinishing, repair and refinishing, and upholstery. And also in the evenings, the most common floor covering was linoleum. Linoleum mm-hmm. in every room in the house. And it was generally about 9 feet wide, a roll, and it was pasted mm-hmm. on the floor. And so after work, my dad, after supper or without supper, we'd go to some homes and remove all the furniture in the room and did that room with a linoleum. Generally, we didn't finish till about midnight or 1 o'clock. And then went to school the following morning. It was no big deal with us. I was young, and my brother, both he and I, he's a year and a half older than I, went and helped him do a lot of the work. And so before that, in the 40s, I was about 12 years of age when Second World War ended. And I had a cousin, Henry de Llano, in the Air Force, that joined in 1942 at the age of 17 on a bomber. Missions over Germany. He would tell me that there might be 100 or so bombers 24/7, the British and all the Allies bombing Germany. Mm-hmm. And every time on a mission, about half of all the planes were shot down. But in spite of that, and I saw in the news, in the theater, in the movies, all the news about the war. And I was so engrossed, and I wanted to go, but I was only 12. And I used to pray that the war wouldn't end, and so I could get old enough to wow. join and go to war. My dream came true later on in Vietnam. but at that time, I wanted to go to the war. So anyway, and so Southgate, and then Corpus City High School, sophomore, and to tell you about how things were two things that stand out in my mind. In 1949, my brother, who had been working all kinds of jobs since I was little, helping my dad and doing all kinds of things to earn money to give to our mother to help. Even at the age of six, you said, well, how can a six-year-old get a job and earn money? Well, I'll tell you how. My brother and I tow sack, una saca de malva, in the neighborhood, la vecindad, las casas. Señora, no tiene unas botellas de soda que no va a usar, que las va a tirar. There were 6-ounce bottles of Coke, 7-Up, Dr. Pepper, RC, whatever. There were 6 ounces. We would put them in a sack, take them to the grocery store. They gave us a penny refund. Yeah, a bottle. Sure. How do we know that?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So wait, man. And something my mother never, ever told us we had to do. We came home with so much pride and gave her whatever money. Then downtown during the war, we would sell newspapers and had a shoeshine box and on after school, in the evening, still midnight. But during the summer, all day, every day, all day until we made at least a dollar a day.
Hmm.
We brought that money in cash, gave it to our mom. 1947, we got hired at a regular job where it's a bowling alley. We were pin setters and did two machines setting up the pins. We worked from 11 a.m. to 1 a.m., 14 hours, sometimes 14 and a half or 15. But we worked 100 hours a week at about 7 cents an hour.
Wow.
In the summer, right? And even then, every 2 weeks, we would bring we'd cash our check, pay my check, and we would bring our mother the money. And that's what we grew up with. In 1949, my brother David and I bought a lot at 310 Shawnee and had to build a house for our mother because we were very poor, only pan, three-room house, still there, falling apart. And so that's what we did. And the payment for the house on Shawnee was $37.50 a month. In 1950, we got finished. My brother David, to make sure that we had the $37.50, because you had to had a mortgage that if you didn't pay, you would lose the house. My brother David, to make sure that that wouldn't happen, left school, joined the army. So he would send however much of his pay.
Right.
About $70 a month, so we have money left over. And so he did that. And so, and I was still in school. And I need to tell you that we did a lot of work in the refinishing business to customers that came to see my dad about furniture being refinished. In 1949, when we moved to the new home there on Shawnee 310, Mr. Allison had only one eye. Elderly business, he did whatever he did, pipe fitting, I don't know, whatever he did. He came with some furniture, and I was in the backyard with some boards trying to build up a shop. And he said, Tony, what are you doing? It's in the afternoon. I said, Mr. Allison, I need to work to help family. I'm trying to build a shop. He told the boys, the men he had there with him, tear it down. And go get some pipes. And they built us a 20 by 24 garage, big door, completely finished for us to work in. And I said, Mr. Allison, there's no way we can pay for this. He said, did I tell you I was going to charge you? He says, it's yours. Well, that's one thing. The other thing that happened to me in 1950, finishing up my year at sophomore year at Miller, we did a lot of work for Miss Mary Lou Locker. Her husband owned a air conditioning business, and she liked me, like most of my teachers and a lot of other people that we did work for. Anglo-Americans, families, they were marveled and admired us and told us how happy they were that we were so mannerly, courteous, polite, respectful, you know, and, you know. And we always tell them, my mother and my dad always, this is what they've taught us, you know. And so Mrs. Locker told me, Tony, how would you like to go to a private school in Dallas, one of the best, or one of the best in the state of Texas, or one of the best in the country? It's for, all for boys, first grade to 12th grade. It won't cost you anything. So I said, okay. And my mother, my dad said, fine, you know, if that's going to help you. All boys school, St. Mark's School of Texas.
Oh, I was going to ask you about
St. Mark's. I don't know if you know. Right now, sir.
Keep going.
The tuition for day classes, they don't have a boarding anymore.
Okay.
You know, provision for a dormitory no more. I went as a boarding student, which cost a lot more.
Yes.
But right now, the upperclassmen at St. Mark's is like $29,000-$30,000 a year for day classes, right? So I went there. The only Mexican-American, all Anglo, first through 12th grade. And all of them, Monday morning, limousines, Cadillacs, whatever, a chauffeur. They all were wealthy families, a lot of them in the oil business.
Sure.
Okay, and here I am, you know, and so it helped me to see how those folks lived, you know.
And how did you interact with those, and how did they interact with you?
With this is extremely important, sir, because we saw where, in some ways, growing up, in some places. My wife and I talk about this all the time, even right now, sir. Whenever we deal with non-Hispanic, so-called white Anglo individuals, citizens, I can tell how genuine, how whether they really mean to be, or if they're really, okay? They were so good to me, and the headmaster took a liking, and he was retired Navy, so I joined at his suggestion, recommendation, Naval Reserve, on the 11th of April in 1951, Naval Reserve. In the meantime, they put me again in 50-51 as a sophomore, which I already finished at Miller as a sophomore. But because of my dedication to my studies and my diligence and just studying day and night, I was able to move from the 10th grade to the 12th grade by the following year. Okay. Now, these are kids that have been to St. Mark's or Jesuit High School or whatever, private school, all their life from first grade. And they had the best of everything, tutoring. In summer, they were going to study in France or England or, you know, all over the world. Their vacation was a trip maybe around the world. Anything like that I did. But that, you know, the thing is that I really wanted to excel and do well. And so here's Mrs. Locker that I never did know if it was a scholarship, but there were no others that I knew, you know, poor like I was, certainly no minority Hispanic or Mexican American. Mrs. Locker, and then Mr. Eigelhart, the headmaster, and then my senior year, Carl Estes, Skeeter, nicknamed Skeeter, okay, but he was a year behind me. I had a sister going to Hockaday. If you've heard Hockaday, it's sort of the equivalent, but it's also, even more expensive than okay. And so I Estes Lynn. And so I didn't, they all had a girlfriend. And I, so anyway, I asked, they were invited to their home. Father, federal judge Estes, Joe Estes. And then I went, they invited me to church at SMU, Methodist Church, after which we went to the country club, North Dallas Country Club. And I went in the huge dining room after church on Sundays. And all of the help in the dining room, tuxedos, very proper, whatever. They would see me and say, habla español tú? Sí, como no? ¿Y qué están haciendo aquí?
You're right.
Yo soy huésped de la familia Estes. ¿O del juez? Ah, sí, dijo. ¿Y cómo le hiciste? No puedo ir a la escuela con el hijo de ellos. And they thought that I always had a lot of money. Porque I would dress up. Mm-hmm. They would help me with that as well. But I'm just telling you that because in my experience, where we have experienced or seen where we're not really accepted or considered an equal or desirable or in parity and, you know, this type of thing, there, in my lifetime, my experience has been some of the finest people in my life, at least, in my life history that they had no reason to be so kind and compassionate and that to want to help listen with me, you know.
Right.
And so I thought that was, it stood out. And that sort of helped me to become respectful of all people, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And for all the children. In that, and I've always said this my whole life, our people, minority, Hispanic, Mexican American, whatever nationality, when given an opportunity, we can match, we can excel to a high level of proficiency and do about anything that anybody else can do and sometimes better. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so I try to, that's why I, and so being poor and after St. Mark's, then I came back home and worked with my brother. That's when we did work for Dr. Hector. And I started Del Mar and then Texas Lutheran College and then back over to UCC to get my teacher certification and started teaching in 1958. And the HR personnel director, Mr. Weldon Gibson, I went and applied for a job. So he interviewed me and sat down and said, Tony, how you been? Oh, fine, sir. And I saw his name there. He was there just 1 year because he went to the war. And he said, how would you like to go back to Southgate to teach, as a teacher? Well, I would love that. See, I just got married. I needed a job bad.
Right.
So I said, oh, I would love that. And he told me, I said, I remember you. I said, Mr. Gibson, I don't remember you. Or I don't remember you, but I never did see you in the office. Well, I remember you. Okay. So that went on. And then I taught there for about 7 years. And then went to Roy Miller High School from Southgate as a counselor and coordinator of a work-study program, NYC, federal program, for students. Back then it was sophomore, junior, senior years in high school. And we had a high incidence of at-risk students at Roy Miller High School. I don't remember the enrollment, maybe 2,000, 2,500. and high attendance, high attendance, absenteeism, mm-hmm. high absenteeism, mm-hmm. many with a lot of discipline problems, misbehavior, misconduct, and failing. Okay, and not wanting to go to school anymore. So the target population for this program was to help those youngsters with a job. So I had about a thousand applications by myself. I worked from 7 to 7 many a days and weekends. And I picked the ones, they all had to qualify on the poverty guidelines. And I picked the ones that the most at risk, ultra high at risk, and some that had already dropped out. But they heard about the program, came to see me. And there was just one thing, well, there was a number of restrictions, regulations, expectations that they had to promise to comply with and to meet. They could not be absent unless they were in the hospital operating table under the knife. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, if they could get up and walk, you're comfortable, sick or not sick. If they're sick, I said, I'll get the nurse to, you know, try to help you stay or send you home if you need to. They were not absent anymore. Some that had absentee, no more. Secondly, not a single discipline referral. Or else I can, there's a long list of others who would love to have your job. Okay? And thirdly, you cannot, no failing grades. And in order for that to happen, I had a study center at night from 7 to 9, hired teachers to pay them to tutor one-on-one. And then some of the top upper students and the senior, junior, seniors to tutor again. Mm. Okay? Coaches and whatever else from the school. Mm-hmm. And from other schools, and in the library, it's the kids in a couple hundred every day to do their work, and so what happened? No more absenteeism for these kids. Attitude shot up. No discipline. So Mr. Nelson told the faculty, whenever Mr. Diaz wants from you, it's the same as if I am asking you. Or telling you, and I don't want to have to come and talk to you or tell you because he says you did not cooperate or accommodated him to help a student. Our attendance shot way up, discipline, you know, and in terms of discipline, I interjected and I added one of my own rules. You will be courteous, mannerly, polite, and respectful. That's a given. And I don't ever want to hear any teacher complaint that you're coming late to class. Mm-hmm. Your job is on the line. Mm-hmm. Okay? And you have to be all passing grades. And I'm on a monitor every 6 weeks, every grade of every student. I had in a table about 12 seniors there with a stack of over there. I broke it up to give me a list of those that might, any absenteeism, but there were none, discipline, or the failing grades. Okay? And I would, if they were struggling, let's say we're passing only except one class where they were struggling in math. Some kids just math. Mm-hmm. Don't. So I would find my best friend, teacher friends were coaches. I said, Coach, I've got this young, it's a senior, failing math. Oh, no, put him with him. I'll make sure they pass at least with a 60 so they can graduate. Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you, Coach. Well, I don't have to even check. No, you just, I'll make sure they graduate. See there? Things like that. So I did that, and the kids started dressing up for school, helping. In over 70 or 80% of the cases, employees in the program, single parent, either mother, in many cases, grandmother, mm-hmm. or mother and the grandmother, mm-hmm. because the mother couldn't afford to rent or buy a home, so they lived with the grandmother. That, and they, in many cases, the only one in the family working. They got 425, 475, whatever minimum wage, still same. But in the summer, they worked full time. Oh, they made a ton of money that they had never at 16.
Sure.
And so that just they, I can tell you this, I wish I had done what you're doing now and interviewed, because let me tell you, some of these youngsters not only are failing miserably in school, academically, some of them are with the police, okay? And I took them, and what I want to tell you, after I worked with them and the counseled with them, they became model students. And on top of all that, being there for them every day, all day, as a counselor. And like I told you, some of them that with some teachers, I would try to approach them and say, I'm not going to lower my standards. If they can cut it, then they need to. If they earn an F, they're going to get an F. I said, but can't you give them? I said, I was a teacher. And give them extra work for extra credit and at least help them make. Why fail them with a 59 or 58 when you can extra work for a couple of points and make 60 so they can just pass? No, I'm going to, okay, fine. So that's where I would look for my angels, teachers that were compassionate and willing to help students. Those things like that. And so they became model students and just their disposition, they just like a different person altogether. And they thanked me. But in 68, I was in Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, Marine training. Mm-hmm. I got home in April and found my orders for active duty for Vietnam, May of 1st of 1968. When I was in Camp Lejeune on April the 4th, 4th or 5th, in the evening, I worked 7 days in the military all the time, preparation for deployment to Vietnam. And so anyway, Martin Luther King shot and killed.
Right.
A lot of Marines, black. And I was chief corpsman at the hospital. And they would invite me after chow, the evening chow, to have a beer with them, enlisted club. This day I didn't go. Because I said, no, I have too much work to do. You know, I'll do it another time. And so I start ambulances and patients beat up, bleeding all over mm-hmm. the place, just severely beat up. Including some of my corpsmen. They were the club. The blacks started beating up anyone that was not black mm-hmm. because they said it had to be a white person, a killer, an assassin mm-hmm. that killed Martin Luther. And so then the white guys started loading up
Their weapons.
You say, oh my God, I'm so. And so anyway, things like that, and it's not written anywhere. Anyway, so then I was in Vietnam 68, 69. Came back 69, and then applied for a principal. I went to Barnes Junior High to finish in 69, finish the year. And I applied, and Dr. Williams applied for a principal and called me and said, Tony, I see you want to be a principal. Yes, sir. How would you like to go to Southgate and be the principal of school? I said, well, I would love that. So I went to Southgate in August of 69 as the principal. And lo and behold, the teachers that taught me when I was little, and then I taught with them, they were still there. They taught me how to teach.
Hmm.
And the first faculty meeting, I said, you know what, I'm nervous. I don't know what to tell you. You were my teachers. I'm here because of you. You know, you taught mm-hmm. me, you got me to being a teacher. Now it's just your principal. But I don't know what to tell you. And Mrs. Swearinger pounded on the table. And she just tell us what you want to do, we'll do it. this was before school started, faculty meeting after lunch. This will be the shortest faculty meeting ever. You take care of the teaching, I'll take care of the discipline. You will not have any discipline problems. All the employers, go home. And some of them didn't go home, went to the room, said, but anyway, we had a near perfect, and oh, they evaluated me. They don't do that anymore. Principals don't like to be evaluated. So anyway, and so they just said, you know, almost a perfect, ideal situation, because I meant it when I said you will not have any discipline. Anyway, so that's, and then I'm very proud of my service to my country in Vietnam. And then I come home to find out that our many of our fellow Americans they didn't like we were in Vietnam. I didn't like being there either.
Right.
But when we were there, well, we said, ours is to do or die and not to ask why. You just follow orders. That's it. Well, that's what it's a military, that's what you do. Mm-hmm. So anyway, and so I, some of the students that I had at Southgate, grown through Miller, and I had at Miller, got over there, and mm-hmm. some in the first week, shot and killed, some in the first month. And I've always told everybody, I was not fighting with them. I was in with a construction battalion in the infirmary, and mm-hmm. I was in charge of it. Chief administrator for medical in the battalion. But we went to the hospital in Da Nang, in the hospital ship there in the bay and so forth. The corpse that I saw that were in a body bag in the records, KIA, killed in action, 18, I can go for thousands, mm-hmm. 18.
Yes.
And then 19, then they were doing the fighting. From Da Nang to the DMC, Marines. From in south of South Vietnam, from Saigon to Da Nang, the Army. And so anyway, it was sad because we talk about this 58,000 plus 22 every day that die. Mm-hmm. It stopped, and for what, you know? And that's what the people were saying, get out, knowing all the time we were in Vietnam, the powers that be, starting with President Kennedy and before, mm-hmm. that there was no way that we were going to mm-hmm. win that war. So we could still be there, you know. So anyway, and I don't know where you were in all of this here. You're too young, probably.
Yeah, at 68, I was 10.
10, okay. When I tell the story to others about your age, but some say, sir, I was not even born then in 68, because that's 50 years ago.
It's, yes.
So anyway, that's kind of brings me to where I'm. And the reason, I've got to say this, I'm so glad and I appreciate, we talked about this, that you're doing what you're doing. Without this, our history would not be known. It may still, not, a lot of it may not be known. I haven't told you about, on Coke, in el barrio de nosotros, in our neighborhood, all the streets not paved, no sidewalks, no curbs, no gutters. When it rained, knee-deep mud, you know, and in our home, like her home, no running water, in the middle of the lot, the yard, one spigot.
What years are these?
Years? In the 30s.
In the 30s, got it.
30s. One spot, one spigot, faucet. And in the back, another little bitty house for mi tío Tacho. And then a garden, vegetable garden, and like that, and fruits. But that one spigot, so, and no gas. We had wood-burning stoves, and then we graduated to coal, kerosene lamps and kerosene stove. Mm-hmm. And no indoor plumbing. Even in 39 to 49, only pan. There was no toilet to our house, and no water, no gas, no electricity. And there was a toilet in the back. There was a gate because there were two other houses in the back. Community toilet where all the families in three homes, but the families were big.
Sharing one commode?
Yes, sir.
Oh, my gosh.
And no shower. You brought in a un tub, un baño, you know. And one, I remember clearly to this moment, growing up on coke in Lipan, my mother said it over and over and over. Tienen que ir a la escuela. Pórtense bien. Mm-hmm. Háganle caso a la maestra. Y vale más que no me den ni una queja de ni uno de ustedes. You have to go to school. Obey your teacher, mind your teacher, behave. And I better not hear a single complaint from any of you. And then she would say, I will go to your school and give you a good whipping in front of your whole class. She never did go, but we tried to be good students. And so anyway, I thought that helped me all the way through. And she'd always, we were her whole life, you know, very proud of us. So going back to Dr. Garcia, in education, his emphasis in education, my mother and my father were very supportive. He always worked 7 days a week and 2-3 jobs and like that. And I want to say this, that it bothers me, it upsets me to hear our people from immigrants from Mexico, from those generations, my ancestors, and then their families here, you know, mm-hmm. Which we are second and then third generation and like that, criticized that we're lazy. No, sir. That has not been the case in my family, at least, or that we're drug dealers, rapists. Not that some of them might not be. But in our family, however many hundreds or thousands have all been decent, honest people, hardworking, respectful. Many serve their country. My brother, our son, okay, mm-hmm. Two sons that served, and my cousin and others, her uncles, cousins that went to Second World War. And let me tell you what, in all of my family, at least, all of us Mexicanos, minority, that went in the service with the Air Force, Navy, Army, Infanteria, Marines, Infanteria, those are the fighting forces.
Right.
Troops on the boots on the ground, fighting. Mm-hmm. And they all came back. And my cousin, Henry, I don't know how many missions, he came back, they got shot down, somehow they crashed and he managed to survive. But serving our country, up until our son, Charlie, that got help from his counselor at Carroll, that went to the Coast Guard Academy and got, you know, a degree from the academy. And then Naval War College Institute, what do you call that institute out of D.C.? Some kind of institute. Anyway, they do a lot of studying. He also got, while being in the Coast Guard, they sent him to Harvard. He got a master's degree in business management or BA, whatever it is, business administration from Harvard. Never, ever would I have ever thought that one of my kids, our goal was to finish, graduate from high school. And with our kids, for all of them to get a college degree, which they did all, and now Edith with her doctoral degree from here, mm-hmm. and our granddaughter, a doctoral degree, and now employed at Baylor University, recruiting minorities for Baylor, he and her husband, okay, in the STEM program. So any of those things that I see that, And it all translates in our travels, and we've traveled all over the world, okay? Mm-hmm. We come back on the way back, and we come, what is the difference? Because in those countries, sir, we meet some of the smartest kids, highly intelligent, intellectual, and with a tremendous educational mm-hmm. education, with several languages, maybe five or six.
Mm-hmm.
Not only know their language, but English and German or mm-hmm. Russian or Italian or whatever, plus in Espanol también.
Mm-hmm.
And how they do it. Now, I ask you, ¿dónde aprendieron español? ¿En la escuela? So in here, we struggle with to learn one language.
One language.
And people here that want English only. Well, anyway. So, so what we come to the conclusion that we're arrived to is that it's a matter of opportunity for our children. And that's why never, never, ever in my wildest dreams did it ever cross my mind that I would ever be on the school board. And because of my being so tenacious, adamant about making sure and fighting to make sure that every single child enrolled in every class, in every school, in our district, in every district in the state, in every district in the country, gets educated. That's our job, our responsibility by the Constitution. I can tell you and show you the numbers. We're nowhere near that.
Mm-hmm.
And we have the ones that are failing by the thousands, economically disadvantaged, minority, Hispanic. Okay? And without an education, what kind of future are they going to have? A life of misery? And let me tell you what. In those other countries that we've visited, we like to visit all parts of where we go. And in many third world countries, they're born poor. They live poor. They're going to die poor.
Mm-hmm.
And when we say, yes, okay, we have the same thing here for many thousands of our poor kids that do not have the opportunity of getting educated. And we spend hundreds of millions. We're not a poor country. And we're not a poor state. But our state was for about 48, 49th in the country and per mm-hmm. people spending. Right now, they're about 47, 48, maybe 46. But not because we're spending more. It's because the others are spending more. You know. And so things like that in Yesero hurts me. It bothers me that our kids their future. And then what I see in the matter of opportunity for education is for their own future, their own good. But our democracy depends on our teachers because the future of our country is in the hands of our children. But if we don't educate them, what kind of future are they going to, and what it's about? We can continue to be the greatest country in the world, which I believe we are, unless we educate all the children. It's a win-win situation. They get educated, they succeed, they're productive, self-reliant, and they win, and we win. The country, because we need, then we become, when they're employed, higher level, it constitutes a greater number of taxpayers. No?
Right.
And I keep telling the business people, please listen, just at least hear me out. When everybody gets educated and they're have a skill and they're employed and the higher the better, the more they make, the more taxes they're going to pay. But the money that they make, where does it go? They don't hoard it. They're not saving it. The research don't show that people are just saving. No. They spend it, whatever business you're in, buying cars. Man, oh my God, they buy cars. Every year they get a new car. Insurance for food?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God. Let me tell you, that's why we have a problem with obesity. They go and, you know.
Right.
But all the money that the poor people make, they may support the economy. No. I mean, you know.
I think.
No, he does.
I think that's right.
So, anyway, what else can I?
No, that's all very interesting. I would like to wrap up just by asking two things real quickly.
Okay.
I noticed on your resume that you were on Corpus Christi Police Department.
Yes.
Citizens. What was that like? What was your role?
In the Citizens Advisory Board?
Yeah.
We are required by law, the police departments are required to have a citizens advisory board, and I've been with them since 1990. I'm chairman of it. We have to review, I think we have like 3 or 5 public citizens, members, and then all that could be the police officers, officers, patrolmen, and then officers. And so, and then issues, and discuss whatever, you know. Normally it's about the curriculum and sort of advocating for them and letting them know. We represent the community, the citizenry, you know, and so I'm planning to hopefully go to city council to let them know that as representatives of our citizens and corporate citizens, we're proud of our police officers and that we support them and hope that they will support them. And we have been, for years and years, we're always understaffed, short. Just to give you an example, we have in our police department around 400, 450 police officers. Okay?
Okay.
Population 305,000. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, 305,000. We have 450, they have 1,200.
Wow.
And they have a smaller area. See, one of the problems that we have in Corpus Christi, in many municipalities, they're locked in a smaller area. Here we have the island.
Sure. All the way to Cal Allen. And, yeah.
So what happens, the patrolmen, they have a larger cover, so it takes longer to go from here.
Sure.
That's as opposed to where, like, in Pittsburgh, it's a very contained area. But anyway, and of course now there are taxes over there, you know.
Right.
So they get paid pretty good, and their numbers, and so we just I have this sort of a side note. I'm concerned. I don't want to see any of our minority citizens unarmed get shot in the back because they're running away. and some of them are teenagers, mm-hmm. still get shot. You know, I don't know. I cannot support that. Okay? And just this lady that was pulled out of her car by police because she became combative and charged with public intoxication, and they become overly, and you see the law is, when they pull their gun and they shoot, they're supposed to shoot to kill. I mean, because I said, well, why didn't they shoot him on the foot?
Yes,
the
that's
leg?
Right.
No. They're supposed to. Well, and then when a police says, I'm going to place you under arrest, you can, if you argue, if you refuse to give your name, and why this is, I don't know, sir. You'll grab, boom, I mean, before you know it, you know, and mm-hmm. they all jump on top of you. And that's required. And now, it can be a lady, old lady, and no matter, they
doesn't matter.
I saw one incident in the airport where this little old lady, and I don't know who was with her, but standing there, and I don't know why they did this here. The security came over and started asking her something, and then they asked her to she was standing already, to put her arms out. Put your arms out, and she went this way. No, and she kept going, and she turned around, and she looked to be, I don't know, about 90 years old. Well, I mean, you know, and there have been some women also that been, in my view, roughed up unnecessarily. I mean, what threat are they? And to me, it seems that when they shoot to kill, that should be reserved for stuff. If you're in something, you're under attack. You're fear for they will kill you. They, mm-hmm. But you can just so it seemed like they have a license to shoot. I don't know where you all and all this, but this besides. But anyway, yes, I'm on the board since 1978, the Health Advisory Board. The health department.
Okay.
And then MHMR since 1980. Communities and schools since 1986. And I don't know if you have that in the... But anyway, that and former Student Association Del Mar. Okay. And I used to be here before it was A&M on the... Right. You have a foundation?
Yes. Yes. So you were on that board too.
On that board, yeah. So anyway, it's all a matter of our philosophy or what we believe in, and that is that we have the obligation to look out for our family, ourselves, community, and to be a good citizen. Contributing member of society, all that. So that's sort of what we instill and inculcate on our children and then on our grandchildren. And I tell the kids, because the oldest, Charlie's going to the Coast Guard. He just got through with a 1-year prep. Mm-hmm. And then his next son and the granddaughter and the other one, all four want to go to the Coast Guard. That's good for you. So I tell the young people, get the highest education level possible, good paying job. Tell you the same thing. Run for office. If you want to make a change, make a difference in the for the benefit of all of our nation, our state, our community, getting the decision making. Okay, where you make decisions, ordinance, laws, and whatever. And then beyond that, for humanity, we stand for world peace. Okay? Mm-hmm. And what we do as a country, we ought to be working towards world peace. Okay? And compassion for all people, respect, compassion, and helping. I do a lot of study, a lot of research. We have the capability, the potential in the United States of America, the resources to make sure that there's no hunger, no child goes mm-hmm. hungry in the entire world. We can feed the country, okay? And not necessarily by just feeding them, but giving them the technology and whatever mm-hmm. Whatever's needed for them to, you know, in helping them. And we used to do some of that in the 40s. In the 40s, we had a good neighbor policy. The best neighbor of the United States was Mexico. Open border. The farmers, ranchers, they would come on, they mm-hmm. got a green card like my dad, to work permit, to live here, legal residence. They just couldn't vote other than that. And they could apply for citizenship, you know, and so forth. So there's a whole lot of that we could do as good neighbors, as good citizens, not only of our country, but for other countries, you know. And so, but now it seems that right now, sir, we have reverted. We're going back, oh, my God, to before. Oh, listen, with the immigrants? No, that's a huge injustice. No different from Germany and Third Reich, what they did with the Jews. Okay, and what they did with the Jews happened here in the 20s with the Germans. And the bilingual in those was protested, and German, English. Mm-hmm. And now they went now to Spanish and English.
Right.
Yeah. And so anyway, there was book burning events in this country with the German books.
Right.
So anyway, we can go on.
You actually the last couple of minutes you wrapped up the questions I was going to ask.
Oh, no.
So that worked out nicely. thank you so much.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
Time.
And I want to thank you. Oh. Because, you know, all of this here, we probably need to, we're going to get a copy
You'll
of
get a copy of all
so
this.
So we'll have it in writing and in the tape, I guess, or the.
Correct. In fact, I'm going to go ahead and wrap this up. This has been an interview with Maria and Mr. Tony Diaz. And this is the end of the interview.